Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Two of Florida's cabinet members have raised the stakes in the ongoing saga of Governor Rick Scott's dealings with the former commissioner of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement.
I think it's important that the processes that are already built in work and that there should be some follow-up to those allegations.
Also this week, Florida lawmakers gather for committee week in Tallahassee, and much of their discussion centers around the state's economy.
We know, we feel that the state is in a strong recovery. We're looking for some public policies that can help sustain that.
Lawmakers were also talking about police body cameras, allowing underage members of the military to rent hotel rooms, and we'll also learn the latest on the BP oil blowout settlement. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. We start this week's Capitol Report with the same story that led last week's program, the ongoing and some would say deepening rift between Florida's governor and a number of other powerful state government players over the matter of a prominent law enforcement chief who left his job under orders from the governor. Governor Scott is facing more calls for an investigation into the firing of former Florida Department of Law Enforcement Commissioner Gerald Bailey. Lynn Hatter reports the governor's administration has released its version of the events leading up to Bailey's departure.
When the state's transportation chief stepped down, no one blinked. When Governor Rick Scott named new heads of the Department of Corrections and Juvenile Justice, it was over and done with. But when Gerald Bailey resigned as head of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, the question was why. And by the time Bailey's successor, Rick Swearingen, was confirmed earlier this month, the question of why became what happened. Bailey was FDLE chief through three governors, and as Attorney General Pam Bondi noted shortly after his removal, Bailey was widely respected.
I think he is an amazing man. It's interesting because I almost talked about him today.
Governor Rick Scott's office released a 2-page 10-question and answer sheet detailing its take on Bailey's resignation. It says it told Bailey on December 16th that it wanted him out and notified the staff of Bondi, Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam, and Chief Financial Officer Jeff Atwater of the change. All three initially said they believed Bailey resigned voluntarily, but Bailey has said he was forced out. Bailey has also made several accusations against the governor's office. He has said Scott's staff tried to get him to falsely target the former Orange County clerk of court in an investigation into the escape of prisoners. Scott's office denies that. Bailey also says the governor's office tried to get him to quash a federal money laundering investigation into a potential appointee. The governor's office says that's not true. But Bailey's claims led Democratic lawmakers to call for an investigation.
To take a man who has given his life as a real public servant in law enforcement in this state, and to remove him smacks of shenanigans that we don't know anything about.
Review what occurred, ask some questions, and really kind of publicly have a discussion where a lot of us that are extremely concerned have some answers. I mean, that seems to be the biggest problem right now.
Those are House and Senate Minority Leaders Mark Pafford and Arthenia Joyner. Their call for an investigation has now been echoed by organizations like Progress Florida and the state ethics group Integrity Florida. In addition, two of Scott's fellow cabinet members, Agriculture Commissioner Putnam and CFO Atwater, are also saying they think it's time to get a pair of outside eyes to look into the matter. Here's Putnam.
I think it's important that the processes that are already built in work and that there should be some follow-up to those allegations.
And Atwater, fresh off of a rejection from Scott to convene a search for a new FDLE chief, is going a step further. The CFO says he's not interested in even considering the governor's recommendations for changes at other state agencies until the current questions regarding Bailey are resolved.
You could line up 100 people. You could fill up a room. I'm not interested. These people work hard for the state of Florida.
If we're going to talk about someone's talent, we ought to do it right in the open, right in the public.
Meanwhile, Governor Rick Scott has continued to travel the state and unveil his legislative priorities. But at every stop, he's faced with questions about what's now being called FDLE Gate, or the easier to use, Bailey Gate. And those questions don't seem to be letting up anytime soon. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Florida lawmakers have rounded out their second week of committee meetings, which is their way of jump-starting the legislative session. As Jim Ash reports, the session agenda will be dominated by Governor Rick Scott's call for a sweeping telecommunications tax cut. It will also include business priorities, the environment, and growlers, the latter being a fight between beer distributors and the craft brewing industry.
The session actually begins before March. Staff number crunchers set the table in December, projecting a billion-dollar surplus. Doling it out will color everything the legislature does this year. In a Republican-controlled House and Senate, that mostly means tax cuts. Governor Rick Scott wants a $470 million cut in cell phone and cable TV taxes. Average subscribers would save less than $4 a month, but Scott insists it will make a difference.
As we put money back into families' hands, guess what? They can pay the rent, they can buy a car, help keep our economy going, maybe they even start a business.
For those keeping score, that makes Scott's 41st tax cut proposal. One important scorekeeper is Senate Appropriations Chairman Tom Lee, a Republican from Bradenton. He's less than enthusiastic about Scott's plan.
And whether or not we can do that and still address the needs of the Senate and the House is a kind of remains to be seen.
Like Scott, the business lobby is counting on the fact that Republicans seldom meet a tax cut they don't like. The National Federation of Independent Business wants a $104 million cut in the taxes businesses pay on commercial leases. The plan would phase it in over several years to reduce the annual hit. NFIB's Bill Hurley.
We feel that the state is in a strong recovery. We're looking for some public policies that can help sustain that.
Tax cuts won't be decided until the final days of session. Some are already moving through committees over Democratic objections. This week, a Senate panel approved a $22 million a year corporate tax cut. Senator Jeff Clemons, a Democrat from Lake Worth, was the lone opponent in the committee.
I'm more in favor of middle class and individual tax cuts than corporate tax cuts, and that's my reason for voting against the bill.
Still fermenting is a collision between major beer distributors and the craft brewing industry. For years, distributors defended a ban on selling craft beer in oversized containers called growlers. This week, they changed course. Now they're fighting the licensing of craft brewers. Senator Jack Latvala, a Republican from Sarasota, is on the side of the craft brewers. Here he is grilling Eric Chris, president of the Beer Industry of Florida.
So the 49 other states that allow a 64-ounce growler, I mean, has there been, and they've deregulated to the point of allowing a 64-ounce growler, has there been any problems that any of your colleagues that run the associations in those states can point to out of that?
My guess is no, sir, there's not, and that's why we're willing to support the 64.
Actually, Latvala misspoke. The number of states is 48. The Florida Chamber of Commerce is pushing an insurance plan for low-income workers it says would draw down billions in federal dollars. It's carefully cloaked to avoid the term Medicaid expansion to give Republicans cover. Conservatives vow not to accept a single dollar tied to Obamacare. And Senate President Andy Gardner, a Republican from Orlando, is keeping his promise to an old friend. A bill he's fast-tracked to crack down on greyhound racing injuries passed its first committee. It's named after the wife of Gardner's predecessor, Senate President Don Gates. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Still to come on Capitol Report, police body cameras were discussed this week in the Florida legislature, but some law agencies have concerns.
Right now, there's more questions than there are pros to it. And from my perspective as a police chief, I want to slow down and get the answers to those questions before I step out on the ledge.
A new bill would require hotels to bend age policies for members of the military.
The whole idea is to continue Florida's outstanding effort to date, and that effort has been to make Florida the most military-friendly state in the United States.
After 42 years of fighting, tension over abortion rights is still as fresh as ever. And the saga of the Gulf oil disaster oozes on as some coastal counties in the Florida panhandle plod ahead with restoration efforts, as the ultimate penalty BP will pay is in the hands of the courts. In the coming weeks, lawmakers are expected to vote on a bill mandating law enforcers across Florida wear body cameras while on patrol. But as Sasha Cordner reports, the measure's sponsor says it will now look different after recent concerns were raised during a workshop in the House earlier this week.
While the measure has not officially been taken up by lawmakers, West Park Democratic Representative Chevron Jones' body cameras bill was discussed during a House Criminal Justice Subcommittee workshop Tuesday. And as he said in the past, Jones says his bill is not meant to be anti-police.
The one thing you'll never catch me doing is creating something that will go totally against public safety. So this is not the blame bill to go against police officers. But what body cameras does do is it allows the police to be protected from false allegations. If you look at a lot of the reports that have come about, whether it be in California, whether it be in Sanford, whether it be in different areas, they have shown the benefits of what has taken place by them rolling out body cameras for the police officer.
Still, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle expressed concerns about the camera's fiscal impact and privacy concerns. Stewart Republican Representative Gail Harrell says she worries what happens after the video become public record.
If I'm an innocent bystander watching something going on and perhaps in a place that I didn't want my neighbor to know I was there, how do I protect myself from something like that when this becomes a public record? And we all know what goes on with things being put up on YouTube. I can understand people's very concern, deep concern about an individual's privacy who happens to be in a situation, a place that is being recorded.
Law enforcement agencies and unions also weighed in. Springfield Police Chief Philip Thorne, representing the Florida Police Chiefs Association, says there are a lot of unanswered questions associated with body cameras that a work group created by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement and consisting of other law agencies are still trying to iron out.
What's it going to cost us to keep, repair, replenish cameras? We tell our police officers to video when they're doing interactions with the public. How are we to limit them on what those interactions are to be that we record if we're going to be open and honest and if it's for accountability purposes? If we utilize a third-party vendor to do our storage for us, what's that cost going to be?
Thorne says it should be up to the local chief or governing body to decide, not the state. And the Florida Sheriff's Association's president, St. Johns County Sheriff David Schoer, agrees.
There are reasons why some communities would want body cameras in their community or some do not. My community, St. Johns County, we don't have the red light cameras, and we don't have hardly any cameras because our community doesn't support it, and we're able to do our job without it. You know, dashboard cameras, red light cameras are other examples of public safety technology that is a community-specific decision that should be made with our citizens.
Jones' bill was filed after high-profile use of force incidents occurred in Ferguson, Missouri and New York, but there are no Florida statistics regarding use of force incidents, and Stephen Vaughn suggests doing a pilot where universities do a study to chart those stats instead. Vaughn has been a law enforcement officer for 24 years and a use of force instructor for 17. Also a representative of the Florida Police Benevolent Association, he says while he likes body cameras, there's a limit to what they can do. And Vaughn drew comparisons between dashboard cams and body cameras.
If I've made a traffic stop and I've pulled an occupant of the vehicle out, could capture someone removing themselves from the vehicle with a weapon headed back towards the police cruiser, which would not be caught by the on-body camera of the officer.
And speaking for the Florida Prosecuting Attorneys Association, State Attorney Glenn Hess says it will also be a problem for both state attorneys and public defenders.
We do not have the equipment in place to receive, catalog, and store the many, many, many videos that will be generated for each shift if every patrol officer videotapes their citizen encounters. This is a problem for the public defenders as well. When they receive a case, they have an obligation to review all of the evidence or the potential evidence for their clients. I can tell you, if we don't have the manpower to do it, they certainly don't have the manpower to do it.
But the measure may already be in jeopardy in the Senate after recent remarks by Baker Republican Greg Evers. He chairs the Senate Criminal Justice Committee, the bill's likely first stop.
We will address looking at this issue and taking testimony, but as far as actually doing something with it this year, at this point, I don't see it happening unless somebody on my committee has a better idea that wants to jump into it. Because, you know, there are certain law enforcement agencies out there that are actually getting these things, and I think that what we'll do is give them opportunity to sort of field it out, then we'll take and go from there.
Still, Jones is encouraged lawmakers even workshop the bill. On Friday, he said since the workshop, he's met with stakeholders to change his bill to meet many of the concerns raised, which includes local discretion.
I think how we constructed the new language is something that everyone can get on board with, because we're not mandating anymore. We're just asking that those individuals who have it create some type of structure and have a policy and procedures in place.
Jones says the House Criminal Justice Subcommittee is slated to take up the bill next month, and he'll be meeting with Senator Evers soon to see if he'll consider the proposal in the Senate with the new language. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Lawmakers are looking to the hospitality industry for help reaching the state's new goal of making Florida the most veteran-friendly state in the union. Regan McCarthy reports a bill would require hotels to bend rules for military members who otherwise would not be old enough to book a room.
Representative Bill Hager says his bill shows members of the military Florida supports them.
We have 21 military bases here. We have significant military operations in Jacksonville, in Pensacola, and we're going to continue to welcome all military personnel. We're going to continue to advise them that this is the state to be in.
Hager says he's heard stories of military members in other states who needed a place to stop on their way back to a military base, but couldn't get a room because of a hotel's age policy. And he's not the only one. Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association Public Affairs Vice President of Governmental Relations, Richard Turner, says his own son, who serves in the Navy, had a similar experience. Eventually, everything in that case worked out, but Turner says hotels in Florida don't want to be inflexible.
And we're the hospitality industry, and what we're talking about here is a very small group of young people that are in a unusual little age bracket where sometimes lodging or car rentals or things can be very difficult because they're not 21 or older. And we think this is a wonderful accommodation for a very small group of people. It's a nice tip of the hat to our military. And while we generally don't, you know, we're always wary of regulations, this is one of which we would support totally.
Turner says many hotels in Florida are already making exceptions for military members. The association has surveyed its members on the topic.
And they almost always waive that policy when a young military person comes in to, you know, seek a room. So generally it wouldn't affect us anyway because we already voluntarily waive that policy for our young military folks.
One example of that is the DoubleTree in Tallahassee. John Kelly is the general manager at the hotel, but
at the DoubleTree, I go by the Cookie King, since that's our brand identity. So instead of GM, I go by the Cookie King.
The DoubleTree's policy requires guests to be at least 21 years old to check into a room. Kelly says that's for liability reasons.
But everyone has to understand we're in a college town. You know, we have three big colleges here, FAMU, FSU, TCC. You know, so, you know, we're very conscious when there's sorority parties, fraternity parties, and even at a high school level in today's day and age where you want a young man or a young girl that wants to have a room on prom night, And, you know, it's not that we don't like that type of business, but with insurance and liability, that becomes a big issue.
But Kelly says his hotel has a long history of bending that rule for members of the military.
It's a no-brainer. To everyone in this hotel, including myself, it's an honor, you know, to serve the people that serve in our military.
He says continuing that tradition, if the bill becomes a law, won't be a problem. And he can't see it becoming a problem for most other hotels in the state. The bill is slated to get its first hearing from the House Business and Professions Subcommittee. St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandis is sponsoring the measure in the Senate. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Some say time heals all wounds, but this week saw the 42nd anniversary of the Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade. And as Nick Evans reports, all these years later, the ideological canyon separating opponents in the fight over abortion seems just as impossible to bridge.
In the U.S. House of Representatives Thursday, the temptation to use Roe v. Wade's anniversary as a chance to vote on anti-abortion legislation was simply too great to pass up. But it was the legislation they didn't vote on that made the nightly news.
In what amounts to an unforced error, Republican leaders had to pull a bill banning abortions after 20 weeks, after a handful of GOP women rebelled.
That's Nancy Cordes on the CBS Evening News. Instead of voting on a 20-week restriction that included stringent requirements in the case of rape or incest, the House passed a bill doubling down on its existing stance not to provide federal funds for abortions. In Washington, D.C., thousands of demonstrators marched, and the occasion brought activists to the Florida Capitol, too.
First of all, I would like to thank all of you for coming out tonight.
It was a slightly more modest affair. Barbara Devane's the lobbyist for the Florida chapter of the National Organization for Women. She organized the rally on the Capitol steps along with representatives from Planned Parenthood. Devane frames the argument in terms of social equality, claiming rich women never had trouble getting abortions.
This is not about rich women. This is about helping women who need the most help, and that's poor women, poor working women, middle class working women who can't afford to fly out of this country or to another state if need be.
Joining the group was Democratic Representative Lori Berman from Boynton Beach.
I can't believe that we have to stand here again on another anniversary of Roe v. Wade and be under attack and be worried about our rights to make choices that affect our health care and our lives.
Among those attacks is Representative Charles Van Zandt's perennial Florida is for Life Act. The Keystone Heights Republican has filed the bill 6 years running. Van Zandt's proposals have drawn criticism for denying abortions even in the case of rape or incest, and because they might not pass constitutional muster. But there's another bill coming up this session that approaches abortion differently. Like bills passed in a handful of other states, this measure requires physicians performing abortions to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. It's being proposed by Mike Hill, a Republican representative from Pensacola. Hill says the intent of his bill is to protect the health of the mother by ensuring the doctor performing the procedure will be on hand to address any complications that might arise.
If right now there is some complication to that surgical procedure, then the doctor who's performing that procedure simply calls emergency. They come pick up the woman, and then that doctor just washes their hands of the whole issue.
But Berman isn't buying the women's health claims.
I mean, that's the purported idea, and that's what is proposed, but in reality, it's a fallacious argument.
Berman argues it can be difficult for doctors to gain admitting privileges, and there's little medical reason for it to begin with. The mortality rate for women getting abortions is extremely low, lower, in fact, than many other outpatient procedures like colonoscopies. In some states, similar requirements have made it significantly more difficult for women to access abortion services, and Berman fears the same could happen in Florida if the bill passes. It's too soon to say whether the bill has a shot in the coming session, but unfortunately, it seems clear the argument won't be settled before Roe turns 43. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill's impact continues along America's Gulf Coast. Cleanup efforts have hinged largely on a settlement from Transocean, which actually operated the rig that exploded. In parts of Florida's panhandle, oil still washes ashore. BP is now back in court as a judge tries to figure out how much the company will have to pay in penalties. And as Matthew Seeger reports, some Florida counties continue their restoration projects.
Escambia County is right in the not-so-sweet spot of Florida's counties hit hardest by 2010's Deepwater Horizon oil spill. The spill will cause tens of billions of dollars in cleanup charges, fines, and settlements, and many say it is still blighting the environment. The damage still lingers long after BP declared its work done. The Florida Department of Environmental Protection is still finding oil remnants in places like Pensacola's Fort Pickens Beach.
And this material initially washed ashore, became entrained with sand, and subsequently was buried.
That's Joey Wibbs, part of the DEP's beach monitoring team. The Florida Gulf Consortium was formed in the wake of the spill. Grover Robinson, a commissioner for Escambia County and chairman of the consortium, says the group still needs to see what needs to be done.
And what we were doing today is we were just beginning our process with our new consultant who we've just hired to write the state expenditure plan with us.
At first, counties relied on some BP charity and some local revenue to fund their own projects, but a more recent settlement with well operator Transocean has bolstered their money pool. The consortium is moving forward with new funds and new ideas. Commissioners from every Gulf Coast county in Florida met recently to determine who gets what in this settlement, and Robinson says they plan to meet again in March.
It's going to be an exciting process going forward, really, for anyone that's on the Gulf Coast of Florida. Half of Florida is going to be involved in this, so it's an exciting thing.
Counties from Escambia all the way down to Monroe deliberated with surrounding Gulf Coast states to tackle the cleanup efforts. Christopher Constance, commissioner for Charlotte County, isn't shy about expressing the extent of the cleanup that needs to take place. Even in South Florida, where no oil ever drifted.
There's a tremendous black mat of tar and chemicals at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, and it is negatively affecting the environment. There is definitely an increase in genetic defects and tumors and some of the fishes caught off of our coast.
Even though oil hasn't been seen down in his neck of the woods, he says there's still cause for concern in Charlotte County and parts beyond.
We've been updated by the scientific community, and we're seeing that those impacts are occurring and actually moving closer and closer to the west coast of Florida. So the concern here is the long-term effects and the fact that we need to have enough money to not only improve the environment coastally, but deal with what may be an ecological nightmare.
This is not the narrative BP has been following. It's long since ended most of its involvement with the Gulf, but now it's back in court and is next in line for doling out settlements. The consortium members aren't waiting for that to happen. Commissioner Constance says the name of the Gulf Coast game is persistence.
And we are monitoring the situation. Our scientific communities are involved in monitoring the situation. And the good news is that we are a very collegial group. We're all trying to do what's best for the state of Florida and the waters of the state of Florida.
This problem isn't going away anytime soon. As scientists predict, it'll take up to half a century for effects to dwindle enough to be considered non-threatening. That means lots and lots of work. But at least for now, there's funding to back up the determination. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Matthew Seeger.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Matthew Seeger. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capital Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capital Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capital Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust. Empowerment. Education. Employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.